Here's how you know it's springtime in New England. The days are growing longer, the trees are budding, and bears are invading. In many towns in western Massachusetts, black bears are exploring urban backyards and residential streets on a hunt for food in what's becoming an annual rite of spring. Karen Brown of New England Public Radio has this report.
I put out the word on my neighborhood listserv that I was looking for tales of recent bear encounters. Within an hour, I had about a dozen responses. That's twice as many as when I asked for gutter cleaners. Almost everyone, it seems, has a bear story.
I was weeding by the side of our driveway, middle of a summer day, and a huge, must have been a male, literally walked by within a couple of feet of me.
And I screamed at Joan, "There's a bear!" really loud. And of course, she couldn't hear me because she's like, you know, bopping away under the headphones.
Walked out on the porch, and there was a bear with two cubs.
How did we get to this point? Northampton is a college town full of restaurants, clothing stores, and art galleries. Not exactly wilderness, but it's flanked by rural, wooded, and swampy areas that black bears love, and they don't have far to go for easy meals. Our dumpsters, our bird feeders, our compost bins.
And the mother bear lifted this up and swung the door open and knocked the trash can over. And, you know, I mean, we see them in the yard all the time.
Over the last 3 decades, wildlife trackers have counted more and more bears in Northampton. I live near a meadow, and it's not unusual to look up from cooking dinner and see a mama bear and her cubs lumbering down the cul-de-sac, as my neighbor Jane Fleischman explains.
When the bears are sighted in our neighborhood, you can literally track them on the internet. People will post a photo, and then 10 minutes later they'll say, "Oh, it's in my driveway. Oh, it's in my backyard," and you can literally follow them around. And so in some ways I think there's a great fascination for them.
People don't seem to be scared. There are reports of bears breaking into cars or popping out kitchen screens, but no attacks on humans. Northampton writer Alyssa Alford even tried to talk to a bear on her patio.
I really just wanted to make eye contact. I wanted to have that moment where we were together and seeing each other, that contact with the wild.
But does it have to be quite so close?
We love bears. We love wildlife. What we don't love is having them trample through our property on a daily basis.
Janelle Jorda sees a darker side to the Northampton Ursine story. She shows me where bears have destroyed her wooden trash enclosure and crushed her landscape lighting. Last month, a mother bear ripped down her chain-link fence as Jorda gaped from the other side of a glass door.
When the baby tried to follow the mother in, the baby got stuck because the baby was huge and got stuck inside the fence. And that's when I was like, oh, man, I better call the police because I was alone with a huge mother and two babies.
Jorda doesn't blame the bears. She blames a neighbor who's apparently feeding them. Wildlife officials are pushing for a city law to make feeding bears illegal, so they'd have little reason to leave their natural habitat. Problem is, mother bears have already taught their cubs that chomping on discarded pizza crusts is a lot easier than picking berries in the woods. For the next generation of bears, this may actually be their natural habitat. For NPR News, I'm Karen Brown in Northampton, Massachusetts.
Up next, Flora Lichtman is here with our video pick of the week. Flora, you have something relevant.
This time, yeah. Yes, this time is about New York City's animal immigrants, the coyote. I was surprised to learn that coyotes are now found in the boroughs. And this video, we talk with Mark Weckel, who's of the Mayanus River Gorge Preserve, and he's the head of this New York City Coyote Project, although he said he doesn't have an official name yet. He's like Gotham spuriest, maybe. He hasn't decided yet. But the way this project works is to understand coyotes and how they're coming into the city. And so they set out these camera traps, and the cameras take still photographs. And so he has some really fantastic footage of coyotes romping around parks in the Bronx.
Where? Did they say where these guys?
He did not disclose the exact location.
No field trip for that. So you have on you took all this video and you put it together in our video pick of the week, and it's amazing. You can actually see the coyotes
and
running,
the pups
running around.
There's a pheasant in one of them. There's a pheasant in one of the videos. Coyotes chasing skunks. Here's a good detail: to get the coyotes to go to the cameras, to go in front of them, they bait the cameras with a fatty acid. And I asked Mark what this smells like, and he said, it smells a lot like cheese. And apparently, that will just bring them right in. And so you see, the footage you see is of these little coyotes like sniffing around the camera, I guess.
And then these skunks appear.
Looking for Brie. Right.
The skunks come out after the cheese also, probably.
Yeah, apparently. Yeah, I mean, I think not probably to see the coyotes. But I thought maybe we could ask some of our panelists here who are true experts on this subject. Because I think what people may want to know, I mean, should like all the toy poodles in New York City
should be afraid of your dog out? Yeah.
Just like with all other wildlife, people just need to know how to act when they are aware that there's wildlife living in their park. So you want to keep your dogs on a leash at all times. That's best for the park as well. It's good for the plantings and all of the other wildlife. And you want to keep a distance. I mean, people are very interested when they see a coyote. Some people are frightened, but many people try to approach, and that's really the wrong thing to do. We tell people just keep a distance, watch from a distance, don't try to feed them. Keep your dogs on a leash.
And I have one other quick question, because Mark said that they're headed towards Long Island, that this is probably good habitat for them, but how do they know where they're going?
Real estate prices are down, I think. That's what they're headed.
Well, I don't know if that's actually true, because they're breeding here, so I don't know if they're headed anywhere.
Really?
Yes. So, I mean, some are headed, that's for sure.
But. Right. I don't know that they have directionality in mind, but often the first coyotes that show up in a new area like Long Island are dispersing juveniles. So, you know, they've been living with their parents, maybe a small social group for a while. And then eventually they have to move on to find their own opportunities. You know,
the story of Long Island.
Right.
Yeah.
So that's especially when they end up in odd places, like really urban areas on the streets and so forth. They're kind of young, confused juveniles.
Well, thank you, Flora. It's Florida's Video Pick of the Week up there on our website at sciencefriday.com. You can see this is a great video of seeing these coyotes running around up in the Bronx, right? Greg Smith composed our theme music. We had help today from NPR librarian Kim Molesky. And if you missed any part of this program, you can go to iTunes and subscribe to our podcasts and our videos. You can take us along on your iPhone and your Android apps. And all week long, we'll continue our discussion on Twitter. You can tweet us at SciFry, at SCIFRI. If you'd like to write us, go to our website at sciencefriday.com, and you can leave us a mail there. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Audie Cornish. Rupert Murdoch's News Corp sells an overwhelming majority of all newspapers read in his native land of Australia. He also holds a controlling interest in the leading cable news channel there. With such control of the media, naturally come concerns of balance. So one journalist-turned-professor decided to put Australia's papers to the test. NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik tells us what she found.
I pay a visit to an eggshell blue house in the West Sydney neighborhood of Newtown to find the veteran investigative journalist Wendy Bacon and her partner, Chris Nash.
The tree fern in the corner there is Australian.
They are identifying for me the Australasian flora in the courtyard of their book-lined home.
The coloring, which you commented on before, is actually Korean.
And then Bacon tells me of her research. She had graduate students examine 6 months' worth of articles, feature pieces, editorials, and columns in 10 leading Australian papers on a proposal by the governing Labor Party to levy a tax on carbon emissions.
What our study showed is that the majority of Australians are not getting a balanced or diverse view on a policy which was designed to, at least in a small way, tackle this problem.
7 of those 10 papers are part of Rupert Murdoch's Australian newspaper arm, News Limited. The Murdoch papers are seen as hospitable to those who question the science underlying projections of climate change, from the populist tabloids to the respected if combative national newspaper The Australian, even if The Oz, as it's commonly called, has more nuanced and extensive coverage. Bacon says she wanted to see if those papers' coverage fit or disproved that anecdotal impression. In her finding, News Limited far surpassed it. Negative articles printed in Murdoch's newspapers about the proposed tax on carbon emissions outweighed positive ones 82% to 18%. Bacon says that all adds up to a campaign against a policy rather than tough-minded scrutiny of it. And she says Australians simply weren't getting enough insight about the science or the politics to be able to make informed decisions for themselves.
If that's happening on that one issue, well, it's certainly happening on other issues.
The surprising thing is Murdoch himself staked out a different stance for his own company quite publicly 5 years ago, while talking about below-average rainfall in his hometown of Melbourne and drought in his native Australia. In fact, Murdoch pledged to make his company carbon neutral over time.
Now, I realize we can't take just 1 year in one city or even one continent as proof that something unusual is happening. And I'm no scientist. But there are signs around the world, and I do know how to assess a risk. Climate change poses clear, catastrophic threats. We may not agree on the extent, but we certainly can't afford the risk of inaction.
Murdoch and his executives and journalists at News Limited declined to be interviewed for this story. A spokesman for News Limited denounced Bacon at the release of her study last year by asserting she lacked credibility and said the company regretted that she was even able to teach college students. This spokesman told the news site The Conversation that the Australian, quote, believes that humans are warming the planet, but obviously there is doubt among those who claim otherwise. And he said that a market-based solution should be followed. The Australian has aggressively opposed the Green Party's agenda of addressing climate change through greater regulation and taxation of pollution. 2 years ago, the paper vowed in an editorial that it would seek to destroy the party at the ballot box. In fall 2010, a former environmental reporter at The Australian, Asa Wahlquist, spoke at an academic conference where she said she fought with editors routinely over the extent and nature of her coverage.
I mean, I couldn't do it anymore, but I hung in there for a long time because I thought it was important that at least I was in there trying.
Bacon found the most negative coverage in the country's top-selling Murdoch tabloids, the Melbourne Herald Sun and the Sydney Daily Telegraph. The Herald Sun's Andrew Bolt is said to be the top read columnist in all Australia, and he's an outright critic of climate change, writing that competing newspapers that treat it as settled science are propagandists.
With the global temperature now flat for some 15 years, it's time for an honest debate. Was global warming exaggerated? How much have we wasted on false scares?
This is Bolt from his TV political opinion show on the broadcast network 10, which is not owned by News Corp, but happens to have Lachlan Murdoch as chairman, even as he serves as a corporate director of the company his father runs.
Let's have a proper, balanced inquiry into the science before we waste billions more.
The journalists I spoke to in Australia tell me they have a tough time reconciling Murdoch's corporate announcement with the coverage in his papers. Among them, Monica Attard, a former foreign correspondent, host and media critic for the ABC, Australia's public broadcasting network.
And then we were all left scratching our heads as to what Rupert's missive that News Limited was to become a green company was actually all about. Nobody quite understood.
As it happens, News Corp executive James Murdoch, Rupert's younger son, held his own grand announcement in London last year. News Corp had become a carbon-neutral company. David Folkenflik, NPR News.
Philippe Coquard could use some sleep. He's the co-owner of the Wallersheim Winery in Prairie du Sac, Wisconsin, and he's been up two nights in a row. He blames it on the weather.
The month of March was like summer, which we never see that in Wisconsin. And everybody's so happy, and it feels like summer. Well, it's not good to us.
That's because Coquard's 27 acres of grapevines budded a month ahead of schedule, and now there's frost. Coquard and other vineyard and orchard owners in southern Wisconsin are trying to protect those fragile buds. Some build bonfires, some use large tarps. Coquard says his work starts at 1:30 in the morning.
So as soon as the temperature will hit 35 degrees Fahrenheit at 2 feet off the ground, then it triggers an alarm. It calls me at my house. Then I will come to the winery and start our protection equipment.
There are three wind machines positioned at the lowest and therefore coldest part of the vineyards. They keep the cold air moving so the vines don't freeze. Then there's the fire dragon. It's pulled by a tractor.
You start the fire and there's a big fan that will draw warm air and shoots it right and left. And you will cover almost 60 or 70 feet on each side of that device.
Hot in the rear, but still cold at the wheel, Kokar and his assistant take turns driving the Dragon all around the vineyard until morning. So far, there's minimal damage to his vines, but there could be more cold next week. As for now,
I'm due to go take a nap and and rest.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It's weekends on All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Laura Sullivan, in for Guy Raz. Our cover story today, nice weather we've been having.
Today's weather had a lot of folks thinking spring has sprung.
And people our unusually warm temperatures lately have many green-thumbed Iowans already hitting their local greenhouses.
With weather that we usually see in mid-June, folks are getting a jump on sprucing up the outside.
We're doing things that we would normally do maybe in late April, early May.
Local news from Burlington, Vermont, Des Moines, Iowa, and Cleveland, Ohio. Throughout the month of March, you've probably heard the same stories on your local news. Across the country, more than 7,700 daily temperature records broken last month on the heels of the fourth warmest winter on record. Sure, it may be time to lay on a blanket in the park, but climate scientists are worried. They say all these sunny days are actually an extreme weather event, one with local and global implications. Let's start in Iowa, where March was so hot.
A record-breaking 84 degrees hot, to be exact.
Some crops in Iowa are now running way ahead of schedule. Joe Prasaki, a statistician with the USDA, says this time of year, the state usually has just 7% of its oats planted.
And right now, they're at 58% planted. Well, that's because if you plant the crop now, it's going to germinate and grow.
Wow, so they've planted more than half of their crop already.
True.
It's hard to say whether that could be good for farmers, since crops could still get hit with frost as late as April or May, and then you're in trouble.
You could be in trouble, yes.
And if you've got allergies, maybe you already are in trouble.
We probably won't see much relief until midsummer when things do calm down.
Jim Sublett is an allergist in Louisville, Kentucky. He said patients have been coming to him with runny noses, itchy eyes, even asthma flare-ups since mid-February.
Which is probably about a month earlier. The problem with that is because of the longer exposure, those people may be at risk of having more severe problems as the season goes along.
So if you start earlier, you just suffer longer.
That's exactly right.
In Vermont, they're dreading early leaves for an entirely different reason. Arnold Coombs is a seventh-generation maple syrup farmer.
It used to be when I was a kid, you would never tap a tree before what we call town meeting day, which is the first Tuesday of March. This year, you had to be tapping by the second week just to get those first runs of sap.
Every spring, syrup farmers have to move fast because when trees sprout leaves, it changes the chemical composition of the syrup.
As soon as that change happens, the syrup is not very good. Now, the problem this year is that happened very early.
So production is down. You may see syrup prices up this year. You may also see higher crime, says Martin Flask, director of public safety in Cleveland.
Well, you know, Cleveland is normally a cold Midwest city.
Even though in the long term, crime is trending downward throughout the country and in Cleveland, homicides and burglaries are up compared to this time last year.
And we've seen a significant spike that, in our mind, can be caused by nothing else other than the weather.
Scientists say we'll probably see more mosquitoes, more Lyme disease, more accidents since people are outside more, biking, hiking, and driving. Heidi Cullen, a climatologist with the research organization Climate Central, has been closely following our spring heat wave. And I asked her, how unusual is this spring heat?
You know, I think this past March, it's hard to really get a sense of how big of a deal it was for, you know, colleagues of mine in the National Weather Service. It was crazy. I mean, we were breaking records by upwards of 40 degrees. I mean, it was this really ironic extreme weather event because it was one of these rare extreme weather events that you were just like, I'm loving this. But at the same time, it was incredibly, incredibly unusual.
Because it's hard to view a nice warm spring day as an extreme weather event.
Absolutely. You know, and I think this is actually one of the challenges of talking about climate in many ways, because even heat waves, you know, when they're happening in the midst of July or August, they're hard to really visualize.
Right, because these would be considered normal temperatures just later in the year.
Yeah, I mean, Chicago broke records for April in March. It was incredibly unusual.
So these massive tornadoes in Texas this week, we know that scientists are hesitant to link tornado outbreaks to climate change. Why?
We're still studying tornadoes, and there's such small-scale events that they're difficult to really embrace and understand the physics of. But at the same time, we're seeing this sort of shifting of Tornado Alley. It's sort of moving further east. We know that the warm Gulf and these warm temperatures certainly help contribute to the formation of these tornadoes. So,
because the people on the other side say, well, we just report them more, people see them more,
absolutely.
Areas are more populated.
It's one of these things where with tornado data, it's really difficult because of, you know, when Doppler radar came along and we've got all of these storm chasers out there. So we've got a natural trend just by virtue of technology and more folks tracking tornadoes. But that is really, I think, an incredibly active field of research right now. And it's going to be really interesting to see what happens there.
So is it fair to say that warmer weather creates extreme weather?
Yes, it is. Certain kinds of extremes. I think, you know, one way to look at it is if you increase the Earth's average temperature by about 1.4 degrees, which is what we've done, you see that penetrate into the weather in especially heat extremes. So we expect heat waves, and you can think of March as sort of a springtime example of a heat wave. We expect them to last longer, which this one did, to affect broader areas, which this one did, and to be more intense, which this one was. So it was kind of, you know, storybook type of incident that we expect to see more and more of. We also see it play out in terms of rainfall events. So we expect to see more intense, heavy rainfall events when they happen.
So if it's been a warmer spring, does that mean that we're going to have a really hot summer?
You know, it's funny because intuitively, I feel like a lot of us are feeling that way now. Like, oh, my goodness, if March was this warm, if you know, December, January, February were warm, we're totally toast this summer.
Yeah.
And it's not the case. I mean, there's no correlation really across what happens in winter and what happens in the summer. It's hard to say exactly how much warmer the summer will be. But, you know, I will say the Climate Prediction Center, part of NOAA, indicates an above average summer.
So given all this, are we in trouble?
I think what we have in front of us is a case of an issue where the sooner we get started working on it, the better. The thing about climate change is that there's time lags in the system. So you can argue that the climate change that we're seeing right now is a byproduct of what we did in the 1980s, right? I often hear folks say, well, let's just wait and see how bad it gets. And that sounds kind of rational. But because of the time lags in the system, if you wait, you've really got problems. So it's this exercise in trusting long-range forecasts for the future, trusting the science, essentially, because the science tells us that if we don't do anything about this problem, you know, by the middle and the end of the century, we're looking at really a radically different climate.
That's Heidi Cullen. She's chief climatologist at Climate Central and author of The Weather of the Future. Turning globally, this week the UN International Panel on Climate Change released a report. It says we're more likely to face extreme weather events in coming decades, things like more intense heat waves, heavier rainfalls, longer droughts. But the report doesn't focus on things we can do to prevent or slow climate change. Instead, it tells people how to cope better with weather disasters it says we're all more likely to face. Christopher Field, a climate scientist at Stanford, was a top editor on the report.
The statistics on disaster loss are interesting and tragic. What you see historically is that the economic losses tend to be greatest in the developed countries, but the loss of life tends to be overwhelmingly concentrated. 95% of recent loss of life has been in the world's developing countries. That doesn't mean that developing countries never take smart steps to deal with disasters, however. We've seen dramatic improvement in Bangladesh, for example. Bangladesh had some of the most destructive tropical cyclones in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. And by the time Tropical Cyclone Cedar hit in 2007, they'd implemented a whole series of smart, relatively low-cost strategies that really minimized loss of life.
What did they do different?
Bangladesh had a history of experience, and they really made three kinds of investments. They made platforms where livestock could be raised above the storm surge or where people could gather. They implemented early warning systems and made sure that people knew that they should move to high ground when storms were predicted. And they also established civilian response teams so that disaster aid was more quickly delivered and much more effectively delivered as a consequence, mainly of volunteer efforts. One of the things that's impressive about these investments that Bangladesh made is that they weren't terribly expensive, but they were very effective.
Christopher, Bangladesh has made such strides. What cities have not made strides?
What we see is two kinds of places where those strategies aren't really being deployed. One is areas so resource-strapped that they don't have, you can think of it as the bandwidth to make the investments that are necessary. And in areas that have high levels of civil strife, that really tends to be a problem. And the other place is areas that are vulnerable but haven't had a recent experience that have driven home that vulnerability.
So if you were to look at a map, where would you point to?
The problem with trying to draw a map is we know that essentially every part of the world is vulnerable to some kind of an extreme or a disaster. I think if you had asked U.S. citizens prior to Hurricane Katrina if there was a major vulnerability to a Category 4 hurricane, people would have said, you know, it's a risk, but it's one that we think we have under control. Once the hurricane occurred, we knew that there were gaps in our preparation and in our responsibility. When we look at where the extremes have occurred in the United States over the last year, we see them essentially everywhere. Droughts in the west, floods in the northeast, tornadoes in the middle. It really is the case that there is no place on the map that is totally immune to climate extremes and disasters.
Christopher Field is the director of the Department of Global Ecology at the Carnegie Institution of Washington. By the way, there are some places still fending off winter. This Easter Sunday, northern Maine could see 4 inches of snow. Not such great news for all the plants that thought it was spring just a few weeks ago. Stay with us. You're listening to Weekends on All Things Considered from NPR News.